Okay, welcome to the Thursday Morning Show. This is Gene Porter, and it's another opportunity for us to spend a couple of hours talking about what I like to talk about best, which is the two houses of Israel and everything that's happening with them now. This morning, Bonnie's not with me because she had somewhere she had to be today, and so I got on my knees and I asked my my co-show person on every Sunday, Joe Good, if he would be willing to come and spend 2 hours of his very busy time with us. Joe, I can't thank you enough. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for asking me.
This will be fun. We're going to interview Jodel Lynn Onstoff this morning. And Jodel, actually, we spoke with Jodel on the program, it's been, 1 or 2 months ago. It wasn't very long ago. And we discussed the same book we're going to discuss this morning. It's an amazing book. It's entitled Yud-Heh-Vav, Hey, Yahweh Exists, which, is a foregone conclusion for a bunch of us, but there are a lot more of us that claim to believe that but don't really understand what we're saying. And I think Jodel's got some great stuff for us today. What I forgot to ask her the last time that we had her on was how she got to the point of writing a book called Yahweh Exists. And I think that would be very important, very interesting to know how exactly she arrived at where she's at. Jodel, would you mind telling us a little bit, the Reader's Digest version of your past?
Sure. Good morning, Gene and Joe. It's great to be here with both of you. And thank you for having me on.
Absolutely.
For me, I started out, I was raised Christian. I was not probably different than most of your listeners, had a relationship with God, was very committed and very comfortable with my religious ideology. Now, I was raised Seventh-day Adventist, so that presented a little bit of problems with a certain prophet that we had in Ellen White. So as I got older and, you start developing your own concepts of right and wrong and ideas of truth, I started seeing flaws, things that didn't match up with scripture. So kind of going down that path and questioning there, I was able to say, okay, certain things here don't line up with scripture. Where does that end? So that's really where I start. I probably became messianic in the early 90s. And I was very comfortable, but then I started reading more academically. And I started reading books that challenged ancient Israel's validity, whether it was their historical validity or the validity of their scriptures. And that really got me going because, modern academia, at least the predominant thought there, is that scripture, the Tanakh, was written more or less as redaction in the reign of Josiah, and that it is not authentic. While there may be some authentic strains, the entire work is not to be trusted and that it was written very, very late in the history. People like Van Setters take it even way late into the second century. So you have lots of conflicting ideas and conflicting opinions. But having been blessed with a very firm foundation rooted in a very Torah background, I saw a lot of good there. And so for myself, I had come to the point where I was considering being atheist, agnostic. I was not sure where I was going to fall. So I said, before I toss everything away, before I walk away from this, something that's been a blessing in my life, I couldn't really deny the blessing that I had received from following the Torah precepts. I said, before I walk away from everything, I have to prove to myself whether this is legit or whether it's man-made. So it began what ended up being a 15-year quest. At the time, I thought it was going to be maybe a few months, and those months just kept recycling over and over again. So I began studying and I began examining that. I started in Genesis. And the other thing that was in my mind at the same time was whether I looked at Seventh-day Adventist, Baptist, Methodist, Messianic, Judaism, all of the religious branches, all of the religious sects, they all have a different idea of Yahuwah or God, and what he requires of man and what our relationship is to each other. So in a way, it's as though we've created many gods, even though we see ourselves as monotheistic, we've created many ideas of God and what he requires man to do. So I said, logically speaking, if we have conflicting ideas, they probably are not all correct. There's a lot of man-made error in there. So what happens?
We've turned him into the ultimate schizophrenic.
We really have. When you look at history, you see how nations and peoples and religions have been divided on this. I mean, wars have been fought over religion. And then you look at the oppression that so many oftentimes comes with religion. You know, somebody has to be a grand poobah and issue edicts for everybody else to follow. So there tends to be a whole lot of control and a whole lot of, you know, oppression that accompanies religion, and it gives religion a bad name. So my quest then became, well, what if we get rid of this man-made baggage that has attached itself to the name of God? What if we just stick with what is written? We don't add to, we don't take away from. Where would that lead us? And is there something pure that can be redeemed in such a quest? So I tried to take a very scientific approach. You know, although I have in my book, I have a lot of spiritual stuff in there. Like part of my chapter seven deals with the spiritual nature of the law and showing how much spirit food there is in there for us and how it just really meets so many of our needs when we read it for what it actually says. But predominantly, I took a scientific approach to the law and tested it and said, is this good for us? You know, what good would it be if there's a God that exists, but he gives us a law that is not good for us? And when we go back in history, we find, if you look at Micah 6:2, we find that was ancient Israel's polemic. They said that Yahuwah had given them a law that could not be kept, that it was too hard for them, that it was unfair, it was unequal. And there was this whole entire controversy in Israel over the validity of the law and whether it was good for Israel or not. So in Micah, Yahweh says, "Hear, O you mountains," Yahweh's controversy with his people. He says, try this case. So that was kind of my mantra in my opening chapter, was to reopen the case of Israel versus Yahweh and see whether or not Yahweh was righteous. Was he righteous in his dealings with Israel? Did he give them a law that was good for them, or did he give them this law that was arbitrary, hard to observe, and just totally out in left field that caused incredible oppression? So that's kind of where my premise started. And then with that premise, it began 15 years of research. So I tried to, you know, the difficult task was in being very, crossing a broad spectrum of fields. So whether it's dealing with medical issues, scientific issues, or archaeology, you know, I've really kind of dabbled in each of those fields and just built my concepts and my ideas based on the evidence of that research. So, and what we're going to be talking about today is chapter 6 in my book, which talks about the promise that Yahweh gives in Exodus 15:26, that if we follow the statutes in Torah, he will take the diseases of Egypt off of us that so many of us struggle with today.
Yes, I, you know, it's funny. I look at you and I look at Joseph, my co-host today, and you are two examples of people who have taken Abba seriously and who have said, I'm going to find out what he says and I'm going to follow through with it. And in both of your cases, coming from two different directions, you have both managed to accomplish that. And so I agree with you. You know, Abba says very clearly, he challenges us to see if he's telling us the truth. He challenges us to see if his mandates for us will actually make our lives better. And if anybody takes him seriously and does that, I think there's no question but they arrive where you've arrived. They see that what he says absolutely puts you in a position where you are a winner. You are you see prosperity. You see all the good things happen because of the fact that you're avoiding the things he says to avoid and you're doing the things he says to do.
Very true. You know, and it's interesting, you know, that when we talk about the blessings, a couple of weeks ago, very controversially, the CDC came out and formally, after something like 50 years, formally endorsed circumcision as a medically necessary procedure. And yeah. Circumcision and male circumcision is a very hotly debated topic.
Yes.
You know, there are those that claim that it's nothing but male mutilation, that it is oppressive, that it is just a religious, you know, some cult that you do, a thing that you do that is, that harms, you know, males. And so that was one of the issues that I tackled in my book. And I said, well, is this law good for us as as Yahweh commands. I think Ezekiel 33:15 states that the statutes, when we follow them, that they become statutes of life. So right. Is this a statute that gives us life, or as ancient Israel claimed, does it give us death? So what I did was I took and did some of the research. I delved into the medical journals, the studies that have been done. And some of these studies are very, very inclusive. There was one study by Dr. Javier, that spanned 7 continents, and wow. It lasted for something like 10 years. And what Dr. Javier, it was Javier Costa, and I'm terrible with the Latin here, Costalego. What he discovered was that when you have male circumcision, it not only benefits the males themselves with lower rates of cancer, lower rates of sexually transmitted diseases, and lower rates of things like genital warts that lead to cancer, right. But it also benefited their female partners. When you have males that are uncircumcised, their female partners have an eight times more likely to develop cervical cancers. So that is huge. So when we talk about validity of Torah, is it good for humanity? The fact that it reduces cancer is a huge piece of evidence in the whole overall validity question. And, you know, there's a lot of people that say, you know, disease has always existed. It will always exist. It has no relationship whatever to anything in scripture. That's just man-made. Well, if that were true, if that stance is a valid stance, then when a group of people, say you have a control group, your one control group would be your people in, say, average America that are just living their life and have no relationship with Torah. You have certain rates of disease among them that, you know, are just typical of all society. Disease has always existed. But then you have your other group, which is going to be the group that you're going to test. And these people are going to follow Torah. This group of people are going to actually put it to action in their lives. They're going to live by it. They're going to be circumcised. They're going to follow the clean laws and all of this. So if the stance that disease has always existed, there's no relationship between Torah and what we do, there should be no improvement in the health of this Torah observant group. But what we find when we study the Torah observant groups, and again, it's not as though there has been a research that has taken a Torah observant group and really studied them. So what I am doing is I am gathering from different studies in different fields, because there honestly does need to be a group that is tested over, say, a period of 20, 30, 40 years, several generations. But what we find from these other studies, whether it's circumcision or clean laws, is that the rates of cancer, the rates of heart disease go down among the Torah observant groups. And it goes down drastically. It's not just a little bit. It goes down drastically. So that shows a relationship between the goodness of Torah, the benefits of following Torah, and health in a person's life or in the life of a community.
So in other words, Hashem actually does follow through on his promises.
he really does. And, you know, one of the most famous studies, and this is a very old study, but it remains valid today. In 1954, there was a study done at New York's Bellevue Hospital. And at the time, they had a very strong Jewish community. So of over 86,000 Jewish women that were studied, and again, this was among an Orthodox community where it is well known, the Orthodox, of course, practice circumcision. But the women in that community had like almost no rates of cervical cancer compared to the average New York woman who had something like, I believe it was an 8% rate of cancer among the community. So it was just this huge, drastic gap there between the Torah observant and the non-Torah observant.
Yes, Pat. Go ahead, Joe.
Can I jump in here?
You
In Europe, in certain countries, they are now outlawing circumcision. And I fear for what the results of this are going to be, because not only will it affect the individual, the individuals within that country, I think that it's going to have a spiritual effect on the entire continent, or the entire region, and bring other judgments from Hashem that, of course, are mentioned in the Torah.
Very true. You know, one thing in the circumcision covenant, one of the things that I do when I, in the initial chapters of my book, is I go through and I show that every time that Yehovah talked with the patriarchs, every single time he gives them a separate covenant. So he gives Abraham, later in life, the circumcision covenant. And what we find with that is that in order to be recognized as part of the body of Israel, and this would be from a spiritual standpoint, circumcision is required to be recognized. He says, and I believe it is Genesis 18, that if you're not circumcised for males, he won't even recognize you as part of the people. So it's very important. It's an outward sign, an outward manifestation that you are in compliance. But, you know, when we talk about healthcare, on the other side, it's so practical. It's so real. And speaking of what you brought up with Europe and the cost of that, you know, there is a psychological cost. There is a healthcare cost. There's a health and human suffering cost, and there's a financial cost. John Hopkins, a few years back, I think it was in 2012, did a study on the nations, especially here in the United States, where we have declining rates of circumcision. And what they found was that there is a cost of over $2 billion a year in healthcare costs alone in caring for circumcision-related illnesses due to the lack of circumcision in the United States. So, in other words, by declining circumcision, by refraining and just leaving the foreskin intact, it is costing $2 billion a year because you have disease, you have infection, and you have cancers that come from leaving the circumcision intact. A few years ago, I had a friend of mine who is an atheist, and it's so funny because she has very strong views on the subject. And her three-year-old son almost lost his appendage due to his foreskin being intact. So now, having gone through that and being in the hospital for a number of days and going through the medication and just the whole experience, she now firmly believes in circumcision.
I bet so. You know, it's funny. This has an eschatological impact too, because of the fact I've got a good friend in Colorado who firmly believes that, you know, when the baby boomers that resulted from when all the military guys, all the army returned home after World War II, that baby boom generation, of which I'm a member and you're a member, that baby boom generation was pretty much 100% circumcised. Virtually all the boys were circumcised. And he believes that the statement in the Tanakh that if you are circumcised, that you are obligated to the law. Right. He says that's something we as a country have got to come to grips with. The fact that we have an obligation to Torah, and we have taken the first step as babies doing that, and we've got to continue to walk in it. And if we don't, we will pay for that. There will be a problem with that.
Right. And you know, the consequences are there. And so much of Torah, what I discovered in my research, is that Torah simply embraces natural law.
Right.
It's not like it's arbitrary truth. So whether we look at, you know, the laws of relativity, whether we look at the action-reaction law, Newton's third law, or the laws of entropy, all of these laws of physics are given to us in this moral code. And it's not just a moral code, but it's more of a constitution. It defines liberty, and it establishes boundaries between society and government, or between society and each other, or society and God. So it provides this paradigm of righteous living that when we follow it, we reap the benefits. You know, Genesis 6:4 states, you know, if you'll follow all these blessings and commandments that that's just Exodus. The other one is that if we follow the law, that there will be no nation as righteous as Israel in all the nations of the earth, and that will have God so near to them. So there's this paradigm that by following it, it gives us righteousness and justice and peace and harmony within our society. So
yes.
It's not like we just magically come to a point of unity. I think unity is brought by us coming to see the goodness of the law, and it is that law, that constitution, that then unites us.
Yes, I agree with you. I wish we would treat what the Torah prescribes for us in the same manner that we treat things like gravity. You know, we all know that if we get to the, go to the top of the Empire State Building and we leap off of it, we pretty much know what the results are going to be. You know, if we would take that same no-nonsense approach to what Abba tells us we must do in order to be healthy, wealthy, and wise, and we took it that seriously and looked at it that matter-of-factly, it would really change the way a lot of us live, and it would certainly help things.
Yeah, I can't agree more. You know, what is the old saying when it comes to religion? People check their brains at the door, you know, and that it sounds rather harsh, but so often people will come to religion and they just turn off the thinking mechanism.
Yeah, exactly. It's a different set of rules. Joe, go ahead.
You know, along the line of unity that you were mentioning, in accord with the Torah, Israel's journey to Mount Sinai, we're told in Shemot chapter 19, Exodus 19, that he bore them to himself on wings of eagles. However, when we look at it, it doesn't look like that it was a smooth ride on the back of an eagle. It was very bumpy. The people argued all the way. They wanted to stop, to go back. They got attacked by the Amalekites. They had all of these things that were divided in their journey. But as they arrive at the mountain, it says in Shemot 19 or Exodus 19:3, it says, so Israel camped there before the mountain. And Israel is a plural noun. The word that is used for camped rightly should be a plural verb, except it's a singular verb. They came together as one. They were unified. And then later on in the New Testament, we continuously see at Shavuot, which commemorates this, the people were in one accord. And so as we come together in Torah, it does bring a unity.
Right.
Amen. I so agree with that. You know, when we look at society, we're either bound by our ideology or we're divided from it. And when we look across the nations, you know, throughout Torah, it talks about brother being divided against brother and raising your hand to shed your brother's blood. And the only way that we arrive at that horrible, horrible juncture in any national history, whether we talk about the Civil War or we talk about the split of Samaria and Judah, or we look at any other nation later on, there is a disconnect between the ideologies that have to occur for it to degenerate into bloodshed. So what it was it that united America as a family nation? It was this idea of freedom, this constitution that established freedom. And in so many ways, the Torah does the exact same thing, is that it gives us the ideology to live by. It gives us the concepts, the philosophy, that if you walk in my way, if you do this, you will live and you will prosper and you will have freedom.
All right. Everybody stick with us. We've got another hour and a half with Joe Del Lynn and Joe Good. Call us if you like. We'll give you the number when we come back. You carry me through the darkest night,
through the shadow of death, into the light. Find.com and click on the membership tab. See you on the wall.
AM 1220, KPJC Salem.
Okay, welcome back to the Thursday morning show. And just as I was getting ready to endorse you, to ask you to give me a call, we get a call. So I've got a caller here. Rush, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
I was wanting to know Joanne's last name and some information because I'm in Seventh-day Adventist land.
Yes.
And I was very interested to know how you came out of it or if you had any information that might help me.
You know, there's a couple resources. My book will kind of touch on the principles, I guess, or the ideas of mm-hmm. truth. For me, I took Deuteronomy 23 to heart, where it talks about a prophet has to speak according to the word, and if he doesn't, then don't fear him or her.
Right.
So that was part of it. And the other biggest part that I have found, it doesn't matter if it's SDA, Baptist, I don't care what name you put on it, but almost every organized religion today will add to and delete from scripture, which is something that the law commands us not to do. And so anytime that we start putting ourselves of knowing better than God and we start adding to and deleting from, we really end up with something that leads to oppression and something that leads to, what's the word I'm looking for? I would say it leads to being ignorant because we take ourselves away from that life-giving source. Now, a very good book, one that I would highly recommend is Restoring Abrahamic Faith by James Tabor.
Yes, yes.
Wait a minute, Restoring what?
Abrahamic Faith.
That's a great book.
By mm-hmm. James Tabor. And you can
James
get that on
Tabor? T-A-B-O-R?
Yes. And you can
okay.
get that
and
book
how
on
do you
Amazon.
Spell your last name?
Sure. My last name is Onstott. It's O-N-S-T-O-T-T.
I'm having a bad reception. It's O-N...
S-T-O-T-T-T.
Yes, two T's at the end.
Yes. And it's Jodell, by the way.
Yes.
I heard her say Joanne, so I want to make sure.
Yes, it is Jodell. And, you know, you're welcome to friend me on Facebook. I'm Jodell Lynn on Facebook.
I don't do Facebook, but that's okay. But thanks.
But yeah, there's more and more resources out there for people that are really wanting, you know, we get tired of being fed, you know, lies from everyone that we go to. What does Isaiah 28 says? You know, you take this book to someone and you say, read it for we can't understand it. And, you know, after we've done that in our human history for 2,500 years and we just kind of end up at different places, but never at the right place. At some point in time, I think we hit our heads against the walls long enough that we say, well, maybe God knew what he was doing in the first place. Maybe this document that he gave us, actually there's something to it. And I hope that I have done my research well enough and I presented a strong enough case to show that that is indeed the situation where we find ourselves, where the Torah actually meets our needs so incredibly well and provides this paradigm for righteous living that we can do and provides incredible unity.
Great. Joe, I think you had something to say, right?
I was going to mention the passage that you mentioned out of Deuteronomy. I think it's chapter 13 rather than 23 about
Thank
the prophets.
Thank you very much. Yes, you're right. It is Deuteronomy 13. I've over the last few years when I've done my research, and I'm trying to correct this, I'm not there yet. I have become very reliant on Bible programs for finding things for me. So I'll just type in like keywords. I'm great with remembering keywords, but then remembering where it is in scripture, I'm having to relearn that since I have depended on the Bible program so much.
Thank you, caller. Didn't mean for you to run so fast, but I understand. Anyone else who has questions for Jodell or for Joe, feel free to call in. This is going to be a fun program today, and I suspect that many of you are home that might not otherwise be home. So feel free to give us a call. And that's 503-679-3001. I look forward to hearing from you, and I know that both Jodell and Joe would love to talk to you. Oh, by the way, that's 503-967, sorry, 3001.
Jodell, I have a question for you that deals with kashrut.
Yes.
It also kind of relates back to what we were saying before on circumcision. When I became a believer, very, very quickly I turned to Torah. There were some people that I was closely involved with in the Christian church that I was going to. Would go over several times a week and study with this family, work with them in their garden, all of these things. And, we would frequently start early in the morning, and the man's wife would ask me, to have breakfast with them. And she would say, I'm going to scramble some eggs and, fry some bacon. And I always turned down the bacon. Even before I was a believer, I didn't eat bacon, didn't eat any pork. And, I would turn it down just because I didn't like it. But once I became a believer and turned to Torah and told them, I can't eat this, because it's an unclean food, they were offended and actually had me leave their house.
Oh my.
I think that a lot of resistance to the commandments of God are simply because within people, there is an anti-Torah and an anti-Semitic, influence that comes in. And I believe that the part of the circumcision, prohibitions that are starting to arise in Europe, and there's moves to have this in the United States. I think that there's an anti-Semitic and anti-Torah, attitude behind these. What would be your take?
I agree with that. I think that the role that history plays in our lives is very important. Today we tend to think of ourselves as Americans, but when you look at the religious systems that we have come out of, I think a lot, we have inherited that a lot more than what is recognized. You know, in ancient Greece, the idea of sin or the idea of disease had no relevance whatsoever to human action. And in Egypt, action was always attributed to the gods. So there was this disconnect between what I do has I have no consequences whatsoever for anything that I do. So I think a lot of people like your friends probably inherit these belief systems where physical action has no reality to what you believe and what you do. You know, being down here in the South, you eat what, if it moves and you can kill it, you eat it. And they don't realize that those animals harbor disease. They harbor different bacteria that are very harmful for us. And a lot of it is just plain ignorance and people wanting to stay ignorant. And you touch on it exactly in that people have been indoctrinated so much against the Torah, against Jews, and against this whole idea of consequence that they do have an anti-Semitism and they do have this unfounded aversion to Torah or anything related to it just because of the lies they've inherited from their forefathers, the things that they have been told about it. And so there's this prejudice. They prejudice before they ever examine it. And it's very sad because you look at the number of lives that could be saved, the number of diseases and outbreaks that could be averted. You know, the recent Ebola outbreak in Africa, which is just horrific. But where did it arise from? You know, when you go in and you study the scientific literature and the research that they've done on it, you find that another outbreak in 2002 of Ebola was caused by eating the Mandarin gorilla, and that is one of their primary food sources. So every time we have these outbreaks, and I didn't know this, this was something that I learned in my research, is that even meningitis can come from eating pork. So, and it's not necessarily research, and it's not something that is covered in the scientific journals or looked for in the hospitals, was the association with pigs. But when you look at the academic literature of the particular bacteria strain that pigs eat and then its relationship to meningitis in humans, you find that there's this relationship. So, you know, it's just so hard when you see people bury their heads in the sand and they get very offended. You know, religion itself is almost a food where it provides an emotional comfort. It provides community. And any time that you question it or you rock the cart, people become very, very sensitive to it because you're asking them, or you're at least presenting a concept of, well, consider changing this. And that's the last thing they want to do is change in any way because they're very, very comfortable.
That's right. And we don't want to, our perception of Yahweh, our perception of Hashem is this these days in contemporary Christianity particularly, that conception is that he lets us do anything we want and we can always come back and get a car wash. You know, and I think we've really got to get past that. We've got to get, we think that we claim freedom, but what we're taking is license.
Very true. And you know, I think, you know, we overlook so often the unintended victim in all of this, which is the children.
Yes.
One part of my research that I did focused on the diseases that children inherit. Now, these are not always a one per one correspondence, so please don't get me wrong. But what we do find, especially among the sexually transmitted diseases, is that whether we look at gonorrhea, we look at HIV, we look at some of the other sexually transmitted diseases, these are inherited by children. When they are born, they have these diseases at birth. And the World Health Organization has estimated that well over 3 million people in Africa, 3 million children have died from HIV in Africa because of what their parents have done. So it's very sad when you see lives that have been lost and lives that could have not had that consequence, not have had that disease and that death, had they just followed the law and had they refrained from the activities and the exposure that caused that outbreak and that epidemic to spread throughout, you know, the African country. So it's very sad to see it. But then what's almost even harder is when you see a remedy and people want to just automatically say, oh, you can't do it. It can't be done. You know, Uganda a few years ago, I think this was about 15 years ago, actually instituted abstinence as a way of dealing with HIV, and their rates went down drastically. Now, over the last 8 years, I believe it is, they have their abstinence program has waned and their rate of HIV has begun to increase again. But what you find is that when they initiated the abstinence programs, that the HIV rates did drastically decrease. But then once they go fall away from the abstinence, they go right back up.
Yes, you know, I remember one of the facts that I read in your book that absolutely leaped off the page at me was the fact that one of the African nations, I can't think of which one it was at this point, but it was the one where the HIV incidence is so great that they're essentially raising an entire generation of children with no parents.
Yes. Yes, that is very true. I'm trying to remember which nation that is. I'll have to look it up. It's not Uganda, but it was one of the neighboring nations.
I mean, I don't think we realize that. I don't think we understand how bad things are.
No, and you know, what's even, you know, bringing it home. When was the last time you filled out a healthcare questionnaire at your healthcare provider? One of the first questions you're asked is there a family history of heart disease? Is there a family history of thyroid disease? And they go through this whole entire list. So even the medical profession realizes that there is this genetic, not probability, but a more of a genetic probability that you are more likely to suffer with these diseases based on a family association or family history. So, and then what's really interesting is that we find that the diseases we struggle with here in America, whether it's heart disease, cancer, or even arthritis, we find that the ancient Egyptians, and we find this through mummy cadavers, that they struggled with some of these exact same diseases. So it's not like there's something new under the sun that we are dealing with. It is something that is, you know, it's as old as the human history. But where I get very interested and my interest is piqued is when I see that when we come to Torah, that all of a sudden these diseases are retarded and they are slowed down, or these diseases are actually totally halted. And you find that there's health and rejuvenation that occurs in this process. And to me, that is just very heartwarming, and it gives me such inspiration to see the healing that can occur.
Exactly. We really need to come to the realization that we need to be obedient, and we need to do it His way. You know, that it really boils down to is we have to take Him seriously. I think way too many of us that claim to be His are His only to the extent that it's comfortable for us. And we conveniently forget anything He says that we don't want to do. I mean, it really is just like a bunch of spoiled children. And it's time for us to come to the realization that He really did lay out a way of life. You know, the Torah is instruction, right?
Right.
If the Torah is instruction, all we have to do is follow the instructions. It's that simple. Ah, I love this book. I think this book is something many of us need to read.
Thank you. Yeah, I really hope that it will be a blessing to a lot of people. And I tried to present it in a way that people could relate to and hopefully deals with the questions that they themselves have asked in their own lives. Most of the issues that I delve into were ones that had piqued my curiosity because they were validity issues to me. So in many ways, this book is a very personal journey. As I saw something, you know, I shared it with others, you know, and just by writing it down. But what was amazing to me is, you know, every obstacle I said, oh, I'm not going to find this here, or, oh, I'm sure the law isn't going to be valid there. But as I researched, you know, it's like these walls just kept tumbling down and every barrier that I had just kept falling. So, and then what was interesting to me, you know, when you come to the Torah's prohibition against blood and fat, you know, most of religions say, oh, you know, that was just because it was part of the religious cults of the day and it was used in the religious rituals. But then when you look at the health side of it, we find that disease is carried, guess where? Disease is carried in the blood and disease is stored in the fat. So there become very practical applications why there might be spiritual overtones or spiritual symbolism in some of these prohibitions or in some of the uses, say, of the blood and the fat on the altar. It doesn't negate the very physical and the very real healthcare side of the preventative medicine prescription that Yahweh gave to us in Torah. And when we follow it, we just find that the rates of diseases just really fall tremendously among the Torah observant sects of society.
Exactly.
Now, what's very interesting too, and this was something that a friend of mine had asked me about, and it was one of the reasons I covered it in my book. It was about mad cow disease, and their position was, you claim that there's an association between, you know, Torah or falling away from Torah and disease. Well, what about mad cow disease? That doesn't come from falling away from Torah. They're animals or even anthrax. So, but what's interesting when you start researching the etymology of mad cow, which is more commonly known as BSE or as anthrax, you find that both diseases originated from giving animals either their own kind, that meat entered the food supply at some point in time. And with anthrax, that meat was contaminated so that it had the anthrax virus in the meat itself when the sheep or whatever it was ate it. So they became carriers then and hosts of the disease. Same thing with the mad cow disease. Once again, the WHO, the World Health Organization, has traced mad cow to the industrial practices of using meat and bone meal in the feed that is given to the cattle. And this is done on grand scale within the food consumption industry or within the cattle industry. So it saves on price overall for the industry, but it allows the disease to enter in because of this practice. So it comes down, you know, in a modern sense and a policy sense of refining the standards that are allowed to be used within the food manufacturing industry to make sure that they're healthy for society. And again, what we find is that it again comes back to Torah and that there is this correlation between the health and the standards Torah sets and what we enjoy today.
Yes, Gary, in other words, last, yeah. During the last outbreak of the bad cow disease, there was a distinct rise, in the number of people that, in the amount of sales that they had of kosher meats. What I mean is kosher with a heksher, in the United States. For my family, we drive about 100 miles to buy all of our meats, 100 miles one way to buy our meats, because we don't eat any beef or any chicken, poultry, that does not have a heksher. If people aren't familiar with what a heksher is, it's been killed according to kosher standards, which also means that it cannot have any meat products that it was fed. It has to be all grain.
Right.
It was a sharp rise.
Yeah. So in other words, once again, the fact that we didn't break Torah in eating it doesn't mean that Torah couldn't have been broken in the process. It's just a different place in the food chain. Right, Jodell?
Very, very true. And, you know, this is something that I think that is a growing concept, is that sometimes when Torah is violated, it's not necessarily you that does it.
Right.
You know, no man is an island. Somebody else does something, and, you know, look at Ebola. One person crosses a border who's a carrier. He may not be exhibiting the symptoms, but he crosses a border into another nation. And now that entire nation is being wiped out because of Ebola being spread. So it's not always a one-per-one correspondence, because we are a society, we are a community, and we come in contact with each other, and we're affected by what other people do. Same thing with environmental issues. You know, Torah talks about leaving the land as a place that to be inhabited for our children many generations to come. And we look at the disease, the rates of disease along from people who live near toxic waste. You know, that is not Torah. That is not a sin that you or I committed. It's not a caring of the land that we have any part of. But because there are these industries that will dump toxic waste, or they will do other questionable things, we can, if we live nearby, our rates of cancer are still increased. Our rates of different diseases and our rates of different illnesses still increase because of that exposure. So it comes down to you and I as individual citizens, you know, demanding, hey, you know, this is the standard that we want, and then holding our government, our politicians, and everyone else accountable to that standard. You know, and just like anything else, the squeaky wheel gets the oil. So the more that you bring it up, the more that it becomes a platform, and the more attention that is given to the issue, the more that it becomes mainstream, and the more that eventually those policies are put in place.
You know, you're saying something that I've been harping on for quite a while now, and that is that we as Ephraim here in the United States and all over the world have got to realize what it means to be a people group.
Yes.
We can't, you know, Americans, you know, we take pride in our hardy individualism. The problem is that until we realize completely that we are a people group and we are obligated to each other to follow the Torah, we're not going to get it. Well, everybody, take what's back.
Welcome to the Hebrew Nation Morning Show, where we discuss the biblical roots of our people and our faith. Linked to Accurate Precious Metals Refineries, our morning show sponsor at HebrewNationOnline.com. Lines are open, so call 503-967-3001 if you would like to join in the conversation. You can also chat with us online in the morning show chat room at HebrewNation.net.
All right. Welcome back for the second hour of the Thursday morning show with Jodell Onstott this morning and, Joe Good helping me out in lieu of Bonnie, who is gone today. You know, I wish this was a 4 hour discussion because all we can do is touch the treetops, you know, and I love treetops, but there's so much good stuff down beneath those treetops as well. Why don't you go ahead, Jodell? I know that you had some ideas about things that you wanted to present to us during these 2 hours.
Sure. You know, one thing that I think we have done over the last 2,500 years is we tend to shy away from those issues that are hard issues. They're hard because they affect our lives. They affect our loved ones. It may be us personally. It may be a friend. It may be a child or a parent. So we tend to kind of bury those under the rug because we don't like to deal with them. And what I would like to address is a part of the curses of the law. What I present in the second part of my book is that when Yahweh gave the law to the law of Moses, when it was codified and written, he also gave them something that's called the testimony. And you'll read this in Isaiah 8:2. And Isaiah says, to the law and the testimony, if they speak not according to this, it's because there's no light in them. So part of my research dealt with this testimony and what it was and how it worked. Well, what I discovered is that it created this chronological time period of judgments that Yahweh would put on Israel, that they would occur in a certain order. So when we come to the testimony itself begins in Deuteronomy 27 and it ends in like Deuteronomy 30 around verse 10. So it's a very chronological law, say a prophecy. You could say it, call it a law of eschatology. And what we find is that it addresses things that Israel would experience during the diaspora when they were away from the land. Well, that is us today. We are away from the land. Israel is not a nation. We don't exist as a nation in Yahweh's sight right now. So one of the very controversial things that I would like to just touch on today is Deuteronomy 28 verses 58. And we're going to go through about verse 61. And again, when you look at the chronology of the law, the setting of this is Israel is being taken off the land. They're being deported. And this is what occurs to us during our time away from the Constitution of Torah. Yahweh says, if you will not observe all the words of this law that are written in this book, that you may fear his glorious name, Yahweh, your Elohim, then Yahweh will make your plagues wonderful and the plagues of your seed, even great plagues of long continuous and sore sickness of long continuance. Moreover, he will bring upon you all the disease of Egypt that you were afraid of, and they will cleave to you. Also, every sickness and every plague which is not written in this book of the law, them will Yahweh bring upon you till you be destroyed. And then he talks about them becoming few in number. So the question of that, you know, if we are in diaspora today, if we're dealing with these diseases, I mean, who of us does not have someone in their life that has not been touched by cancer or heart disease or some other horrific disease? So the question as a believer, because again, if you're an atheist, you're not going to hold to this. But if you are a believer, the question is, how do we reverse disease? How do we claim this blessing? And how is this curse of the law removed? You know, this curse affects, it doesn't matter your religious orientation, whether you are Jewish, whether you are atheist, whether you are Baptist, Messianic, Lutheran, it doesn't matter. These diseases touch each and every one of us. So as a believer, how do we come back? How do we reverse these curses that are stated in the law? And what I have found in my research is that the answer does indeed come down to the Exodus 15:26, where we return to the statutes of the law. We return to the statutes, as Ezekiel says, that give us life and that teach us how to live abundantly. And so when we see the scientific validity, at least for me, because I tend to be very logically minded, I don't accept things just because somebody tells me. I tend to go home, do my research and prove it to myself. And I, you know, I really think that is a great heart. You know, skeptics are often condemned, in religious circles because, they don't have faith that comes very easily. But, you know, I think it's those people that keep us well grounded and those people that keep us questioning and keep us connected to reality. And so when you go back and you do the historical, you do the scientific research, you find that the law is just this incredible document that does provide a way for us to live. It provides a way for us to heal. One thing that Ezekiel talks about with the latter day restoration, he says that the leaves of the trees will have healing in them. And we look at this healing that's to occur. It occurs, coincides with this return to Torah, this return to the law. And it just provides so much hope when you look at Deuteronomy 30, where he always says, you know, after all these things come upon you, the blessing and the curse, you will return to me. You will return to my Torah and you will live in my sight and you will have blessing. So it's the reversal of all these things. But again, it doesn't occur by wishful thinking. It doesn't occur by faith or believing, or rather, at least not by faith alone. It occurs by a faith that manifests itself into a physical action. So much so do you believe in it that you are willing to commit to it and live by it in your heart and in your soul and in your life. And that is where the healing of society, at least from what I have seen, that's where the healing of society takes place.
I agree with you. We have to reach a point where we are not separating quote-unquote spiritual / religious things from reality, quote unquote. In other words, we have to get to the point where we are willing to take Torah and understand that reality is in that context, whether we like it or not. We have to learn that our obedience is essential to make things happen the way they're supposed to.
You have the New Testament where it says faith without works is dead.
Yes.
The Hebrew word for works is mitzvot, which is the same word as for commandments. Faith without commandments is dead.
Yep. And that's the deal. I mean, we've got to come to the realization that he expects our obedience. He expects us to do what he said to do. And as long as we treat him as though he's not really serious about it, it's like what Eddie Chumney said on this show 2 or 3 weeks ago when he said, what Abba is doing is he's testing the entire world right now to see if we take him seriously. And when he says that Israel is his land to give to whom he wants, and he gave it to Israel, you know, and what we're doing is we're all being pulled. You know, the United Nations is going to get to vote here very soon about whether or not they're going to give part of that land to Palestine. Israel gets to vote pretty soon about that because they're going to have a vote over the government. And here in the United States, we're going to have the same kind of confrontation. And then he's going to confront us and say, guess what I said? Whether you like it or not, what I said is what goes. And I think that the same thing goes in these areas you're talking about, Jodell. The fact of the matter is that we have to take him seriously and do what he says to do.
It's very, you know, people tend to, at least this has been my experience with my background, is they tend to want to make faith triumph over everything else, that if you just believe. But yet I have had so many people that I have known personally that have had hardship and heartbreak because what they were believing in had errors in it, and it led them down a path that was not good for them. And so what I find is that when you come back and you interject reality, you know, you consider the way in which our world works, you consider the way in which science works, and you get in harmony with that, it really then opens the door to understanding greater things. And you know, too, there's this almost expectancy idea, this entitlement idea within religious sects of, because I believe or because I'm a believer, then automatically I'm going to have the blessing. But I'm always reminded of Genesis 18:19. And this is what Yahweh says of Abraham. He says, for I know him that he will command his children and his household after him, that they shall keep the way of Yahweh to do justice and judgment, that Yahweh may bring upon Abraham that which he has spoken. So what I find in this text is that blessing, prosperity doesn't come just by belief. It comes by living in a way. The blessing is contingent. It's based on Abraham walking in this way. Abraham himself has to get with the program. He may have the covenants, but he still has to get with the program that Yahweh may bless him. So it's not just this automatically entitled thing. If you're not living according to the paradigm that's established, then you're not going to have the benefit of the blessing.
Yep, I agree. Abraham is the perfect example. You know, because Christians come to me time and time again and say, well, look at Abraham. You know, his faith was accounted unto him for righteousness, right?
Right.
And then I turn around and I go to Genesis 26:5 and I point out to them that the reason why Abba made his seed to multiply as the stars of the heaven and all those wonderful things to happen is because he obeyed my voice, kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. Oops. So there is a performance factor here.
Exactly. You know, it's just amazing. The more you get into this and the more that you see, you know, I had sent you chapter 6 of my book, which dealt with disease. But in chapter 7, I also deal with the paradigm of righteous government. And when you look at the government that Yahweh established and how it provided freedom, you know, when Yahweh gave the covenant in Exodus 20, one of the first things that he says is, I am Yahweh, your God, that has delivered you from the house of bondage. So throughout Torah, we find this idea of liberty. And it's only by getting with the program, by obeying and following this paradigm that we have that blessing. If we don't do it, then our society will end up in a totally different direction. And, you know, in America ourselves, one of the reasons we have enjoyed the most incredible freedom of any nation that's ever existed is because our national constitution is very, very similar to the Torah constitution that Yahuwah gave to ancient Israel. And, you know, that if we can only imagine the taste that America has given to us of what the future of a restored Israel will be, it's just very inspiring and very heartwarming.
I agree completely. I think that, we need to get past this notion that we can just go out and do whatever we want and come back and he'll forgive us everything and then let us go out and do it again. You know, we got to get past that.
Jay, we've spoken in the past many times about this passage in Judges in Shoftim 21:25. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Ooh. And the reality of that is it leads to destruction.
That's right. That's right. We are incapable of determining what is right. And boy, I'll tell you what, you want to become highly unpopular in America, go out on any street corner and say that. And you'll find yourself behind bars real quick.
Very true. Well, and you know, this is my discussion because I do have quite a few atheist friends and they knowing my stance, you know, they're always sneaking in the back door trying to challenge me on some position. And what it comes down to, and what I say in the end is, without a divine law, if there is no divine law, then you have no stance of right and wrong on which to base your ethics. Ethics change from generation to generation. You know, Isaiah 65 says it best, the grass withers, the flower fades, because the ideas of and concepts of right and wrong and justice and injustice changes with every generation. You look at human history, it does not stay the same. The only thing that is constant, the only thing that stays the same is this divine law. So what I bring up with my atheist friends is this idea of moving realities and moving ideas of justice. You know, 30 years ago, the ideas of homosexuality would not have gained a foothold, but today they're mainstream. 30 years ago, the idea of pedophilia would not even have been entertained for a moment. But today there are some movements that are becoming very mainstream that are saying that pedophilia is okay and that it should be legitimized. They're also saying that rape is something that should be legitimized. And these are people that are given a voice. They are given, you know, credibility, and they're not just, first of all, they're not prosecuted. Second of all, there's just no public outcry against them because we live in moral relativism where everything is right and nothing is wrong. And so it just becomes this very slippery slope. And you can use those very extreme ideas of right and wrong in discussions with atheists because right now, currently, those are ideas that that even they find offensive. But who's to say they're going to find it offensive 20, 30 years from now? 20, 30 years from now, they might just say, well, this is just our culture. This is just how we do things. You know, who are you to criticize? So, again, it comes back to having a law that makes sense, that is actually a God-given blessing for us.
Yes, we need to get past the notion that the Constitution is a living document.
Right.
We need to come to the realization that there are rules and laws that must stand as they are and not change.
Exactly. You know, HSLDA Michael Ferris, he's done a lot of great work with the American Constitution and standing up for liberty. And one of the things that he writes is that the American Constitution is a living constitution in that its principles and its precepts and philosophies need to be applied to each and new generation. It is not living in that its precepts or the way that you apply it changes. So, you know, I think recognizing that distinction provides a lot of reasonable dialogue and brings us back to the core argument and to the core issues of it is that Constitution that protects us and that Constitution that gives us our freedom. One of the differences that we find in the American Constitution and the Torah Constitution is that the Torah actually had two injunctions on speech, and only two. One was that you could not curse your king. The other one was that you were under the obligation to confirm Torah as valid for each succeeding generation. So it didn't mean that you couldn't debate the how Torah should be applied or the best way to do something. But what you could not do was undermine the validity of the Torah itself. And I look at that in our political arena in America today, where we have this very aggressive and very potent argument against the validity of the United States Constitution being relevant for our generation today. And we look at the division. We were talking about unity earlier. Look at the division that is occurring now, because the basic precepts, the basic philosophies that we once agreed upon as a nation and as a people is being splintered. It's being divided because we are no longer following. We're no longer learning, guarding, and doing.
Right. We have a president now who feels like he has the right to unilaterally legislate things that he wants to see happen. And he uses the argument, well, this is a righteous thing and it should happen. Whether or not anybody else agrees with me, I think it should happen. So therefore, I'm going to vote it into existence with my pen and my executive privilege. And
it's
very
true. And even beyond that, when you look at the Supreme Court justices, I think it's Ginsburg has been one of the most outspoken critics of the U.S. Constitution. And at the same time, it seems almost a conflict of interest. On one hand, she's sworn to uphold it, but then on the other, she criticizes it as a relevant document. You know, in ancient Israel's time, your Supreme Court justice would have been your high priest. It was his duty. You know, it was a hereditary position where that was his job, was to make sure that the nation was following and adhering to this Constitution. And it's fascinating when you see this court system that ancient Israel had of, you know, circuit courts there at the lower levels that were very tribally based. And then the federal courts with either the side of the monarchy or the side of the Levites, and how they appealed. You know, Yahweh says, if a case be too hard for you, then let it be appealed here. And if it is so hard that it cannot be resolved in any of these lower courts, then appeal it to Moses himself and appeal it to above the mercy seat. And what people, I think, often forget with this process of appeal in the role that the high priest played. Now, granted, Moses wasn't the high priest, but as that role eventually fell to Aaron, but you find that the role of the high priest in the mercy seat as they appealed to Yahweh, underneath the mercy seat was always the covenant. Everything was always based on this Constitution. So any dialogue that they had was always founded on this Torah Constitution. It would never be outside of that discussion or outside of that basic of foundation and credibility for their discussion. So I think that just really, at least for me, it provides a lot of sobriety of this is it. If we are wanting a future restoration, we're wanting a utopia in whatever version people, you know, see a restoration, it's always going to come down to this foundational document. If it is truth, it is not going to change because it's based on righteous laws. It's based on the laws that by which Yehovah created our world and our universe, and he's given them to us. So it's a very special document, and it's something that provides a lot of healing and a lot of a paradigm for unity if we follow it and if we see it as valuable to our generation.
Jodel, the a passage out of Vayikra, Leviticus chapter 10, which deals with the Kohanim, with the priest, it says, it shall be a statute forever throughout your generations. This is chapter 10, starting in verse 9, that you may distinguish between holy and unholy, and between unclean and clean, and that you may teach the children of Israel all the statutes which the Lord has spoken to them by the hand of Moses. Then you have the same thing, basically, that you're told in chapter 43:22, about the Kohanim, and they shall teach my people the difference between the holy and the unholy, and cause them to discern between the unclean and the clean. And that was their highest calling, was to teach these concepts of Torah.
I so agree, absolutely.
Yeah, you know, essentially, Joe, wouldn't you agree that the Moshe was the lead judge? He was the chief Supreme Court justice, essentially.
Yes, he was. He was, it passed from him to Joshua, then to the elders, then it went to the kings, and then in the Second Temple period, it went to the Nasi, or the president of the Sanhedrin.
Right, right. So, I mean, the whole point is that, what's the function of a judge if the judge has no law that he's willing to acknowledge as being immutable? You know, it seems to me like our judges these days are, you know, we use the term activist judges. But that's smoke and mirrors, and all that means is that they don't have any kind of thing that they hang on to and say, this is always true. You know, it seems like they're improvising. Wouldn't you agree, Jodel?
Absolutely. You know, there's a book that I quote from, and it's a fantastic book. It's by Kathleen Cryer, and it's called The Case Against Lawyers. And it's very interesting. Yeah, she was a lawyer herself. But, you know, she charts this, this moving, you know, and it comes back to the concept of the living constitution, but a moving law that is never really set in stone. It's always dictated by the latest court ruling or the latest precedent, you know, and that takes you from a constitution and from a concept based, and it becomes a shaky ground because it's a house of cards. Rather than building and coming back to the foundation and always building on this foundation of this is right, this is wrong, this is how justice prevails. Instead, it's based on the ruling of one judge who rules from another judge who rules from another judge. So you're six or seven court decisions down the road, and you're at a totally different place your system of justice and in your ideas of right and wrong and in your standards of society. And it really becomes a moving target that no one can hit. And then, again, you come back to moral relativism, no right, no wrong. And there is no sanctioning body, that state that is unmovable.
That's true. Hey, everybody, stick with it. We have 1.5 hour.
J.C. Salem.
All right, we're back for the last half hour of this Thursday morning. I want to thank everybody who's on with us. This has been the most pleasant December 25th that I've spent in a long time, and I thank you all for joining me for it. We had a caller call in on break. Mary Ablel, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Do you want to maybe restate what you called in about, just so that everyone out there can hear it?
Okay. I just think it's been a well-orchestrated effort to take all absolutes away and tell us that it doesn't matter. You're loved unconditionally. You can do whatever you want. It went from the harsh consequences of punishment all the time to now no punishment, no love. And it's funny because, you know, when I have a friend, she's like 90 years old, and I don't even know if she's still living. She's out in Iowa. But her mother didn't love her. She was a victim of rape. And, you know, she knew it. She always knew it. And the thing that I noticed in the Bible, it says that if you love your child, you'll discipline them. And so it's just really, so interesting, the fact that there are absolutes, like if you love, you discipline. You don't love, you know. And it's just, you can't get away from it, and yet our society has, I had seen and read a horror story of what happened to a child who was circumcised. So I knew I wasn't doing it in the hospital in the second, third, or fourth day of their life. But then no insurance would cover it on the eighth day, and I didn't know enough back then to know what to do. And now they're in their 30s, and, you know, what do I do now? It's like, it's the same thing with food, too. I mean, people really believe, if you go to that website I mentioned, people really believe that you can just pray over anything and make it clean. This is the doctrine they've inherited through the churches. And I think it's partly because some of the things they read into what Paul said. But, you know, it's really insane to think that you can, like a witch, you can suddenly make something that's poisonous clean, you know. And that's what most people teach. And it's tragic, I think. It's like a woman just died, a young woman left three children behind with cancer. And I think the cancer, I mean, didn't it say clearly in the scriptures that when people kept his law, they had none of the diseases? None. So obviously, we're not keeping the law, or we would have none of the diseases either. Correct?
Right. I'm trying to remember what you're quoting from is from Psalms, and it talks about when Israel left Egypt, that there was no disease among them, is what David says. I believe it was one of David's Psalms. I'll have to look that up. But yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, and it's hard to approach these issues with adult kids who have their own lives. And, I think a lot of prayer and, opportunity. You know, you never know when some sort of mixed company or something will bring it up, and you can say, well, you know, this is what I've learned since then.
Right.
But I pray
thank you
that
so much.
Yes, thank you.
I was going to say, that was so interesting to hear about meningitis connecting with pork. I've also heard about heart disease. I think it's called knowthecause.com, that doctors have told people if you want to live, you stop eating pork now. Have you ever heard that?
Yes, I have.
Mm-hmm.
Fabulous. You know, there's great resources, and one of them that 100 years later is still relevant today is Dr. Kellogg's little pamphlet on the dangers of eating pork. It was written back in the 1840s or 1860s. And, just a very rudimentary treatise on pork and the dangers of it. And he just kind of takes it apart and says, well, this is the bacteria that it harbors, and this bacteria and this bacteria. And he talks about why. And by the time you're finished with the book, you're going, and why did we consider that food? So it really, you know, kind of puts things in perspective.
Well, wasn't that, from what I understand, in Acts 15, the reason that when they came together and James made the decision about whether they needed to be circumcised, the Gentiles, they said they couldn't eat animals that were sacrificed to idols or strangled. And from what my understanding was, the strangling of animals, that's how they killed pigs. That would probably leave the blood in it, but regardless, you know, that would have mean you don't eat, you don't have anything to do with pork. And then you notice that with all your Catholic festivities, there's always ham. So I'm wondering, wasn't that the animal that was sacrificed was a pig? Wouldn't that be something Satan would do?
I, and, You know, when you ask, my phone is just rang. You know, when you look at historically, you know, different cults had different things that they sacrificed. And I always address things from a historical perspective. And to answer that question, you really have to look at the cult, look at the time period, and, you know, be just a little bit more specific, because pigs were used in certain cults, but then others they weren't.
Okay.
If I could make a comment on the from things strangled, the Greek word that you have there is pedikton, and then in Acts 21 there's another word, pedikton, or it's vice versa. Basically, they're the same Greek words with a different ending. But the actual translation, it's translated into English from things strangled, but it means from foods that have not been slaughtered according to rabbinic standards.
There you go. Now, that's what I always wanted to know. Esau was an excellent hunter, skillful, crafty, cunning, right? Does that mean that when he got his prey, he sliced their neck and the throat without putting an arrow in them? Do you know the answer to that? I've been wondering about that.
I don't know, but I'm going to guess as the son of Isaac, he would have been taught. Whether he did it or did not do it, I can't answer.
But that was the thing, that you had to slice the throat, and the animal had to have no fear, because that's then you're full of toxic adrenaline and all that, correct?
Right.
That's why roadkill and all these animals that died in the snowstorm here had to be buried. It couldn't be eaten, because it didn't die properly.
In Torah it talks about not eating an animal that died of itself. And
okay.
And the reason for that, you know, we know it today because we've had the scientific studies and we've been able to learn from our predecessors. But when animals die of themselves, it's usually from disease. And then, like Ebola, you go and you eat a diseased animal, and then it becomes a huge epidemic that just ignites like wildfire throughout the community. So, you know, he always says, you know, these statues are here for your protection. They're here for your good. And, we don't always understand all of them. Like, for instance, the regulation that you do not have intercourse during menses. That is something that some people say, well, that's just, you know, folklore. That's just, you know, there's no reason for that. Well, what I found in my research is that during menses, the woman's cervix is open. And because it is open, it provides this pathway for bacteria, and she is more susceptible to, again, cancer, infection, and a whole host of other diseases during that time period. So again, it is for the woman's protection. It is protecting her just based on the functions that she has in producing children and her functions as a woman. So
yes, I heard that too recently, that, you know, they were saying that the big reason for circumcision was the cervical thing, but then it was actually there was this factor of letting, you know, like you just said, that and waiting 40 and 80 days after the birth of children. So those two things at play there for sure.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you, Mary.
Yeah,
we really appreciate
you
your coming on. You bet.
Okay.
Have a great rest of the day. See ya. Bye. All right. Okay, Jodell. We've got about 20 minutes left.
All right. All right. That sounds really good. You know, when we look at, you know, for those of us that have come back to Torah and that have a love for it, you know, the question now becomes, what do we do with it? How do we, you know, when you love something and you see how good it is, you know, it's really hard to keep it quiet. You know, the old song, you know, can't handle your, hide your light under a bushel. It just becomes this thing that is such a joy that you want to share with other people. You know, the key in that is other people have to be interested. But I think that when they see us learning, they see us doing, and it comes down to living it. Talk is cheap. We have to live it. And then they see the example that is established within the children of Abraham. That is where I think that the discussion really begins. It's where they see it and they see the benefits. And then as Zechariah says, they're asking, let us walk with you. Let us learn more of this way, because they see the benefit that it brings to our people. And as you point out, it's not just individualism, which is important, but Ephraim also has to learn to work and function together as a community. And that means, you know, not always putting, you know, the individual first, but learning to get along, learning to have a relationship, and learning to grow.
And understanding that if I don't obey Torah, I'm going to negatively impact others in my community.
Exactly.
That's the deal. It's more than just me and him and whatever I do affects me, but it's also the fact that whenever I'm disobedient, I create issues for other people around me, and I don't have the right to do that to them, much less to him.
Exactly. You know, it just comes down to personal accountability.
Yeah.
Even with something perhaps as mundane as a cold. If I take me or my children out when we're, you know, struggling with the sniffles, and I go and I expose people to it, you know, that is not loving my brother. That is not showing, you know, Torah love towards someone else and getting everyone else sick. Now I realize we live in a society where you got to be to work, you have to do things, and you got to do what you have to do. But at the same time, you're keeping those viruses, you're keeping those illnesses circulating among your community, because, you know, it just keeps hopping from person to person until you either A, build up an immunity to it, or B, the virus is so worn down that it eventually dies out.
Yes.
You know, but the promise, you know, and this is what I love with Torah and the Tanakh, or the promises. You know, I'm sure one of your favorite, if it's not, I think most of our favorite, is 2 Chronicles 7:14, where he always says, you know, if my people that are called by my name shall humble themselves, pray and seek my face, and here's the key, turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven, I will forgive their sin, and I will heal their land. So the people are healed by the land being healed. And again, it comes from turning from our ways.
Isn't it ironic that that's exactly the excerpt that Americans, almost without exception, go to on July 4th?
Yes.
I mean, that's a standard practice. We all whip our Bibles out and go to that excerpt from Chronicles and read it. And we all stand there with somber faces, you know, and pray fervently. And then we immediately slap those Bibles back together and get right on with what we were doing 5 minutes before that happened.
Exactly. It's like a
pork hot dog in your head.
Yeah, right. You know, we don't understand. And you know what amazes me is I look now at the Torah and I ask myself, how is it that I ever thought this was a burden?
Right.
I can't imagine living without it now. I mean, it would be a horrible thing to think that, I don't have the Torah there to make the rules for me.
Right.
You know, if I, it's something that I can't do without now.
The best thing about the laws or the commandments is that you have to choose. And since you have to choose, for instance, kashrut. Kashrut is our favorite commandments because the kitchen is the center of the home, and everything that you buy in the store, everything that you prepare in the kitchen and how you prepare in the kitchen and everything you eat, you have to make a choice. And that choice causes you to think about Hashem. And so your spiritual walk just goes hand in hand as you do these things. It grows, it prospers, and, It transforms your entire life.
I agree completely. I can't even imagine. I remember the old days. I remember when I had those thoughts and I had those things in my head about how, you know, it's so good that we're not subject to the law anymore. And now I realize that without the law, I am a loose cannon. And every negative aspect of being a loose cannon characterized me.
You know, for me, it was more of everything dwelling in a shade of gray.
Yes.
And, you know, I would study a subject one way this time and I'd see it this way. I might study it 2 weeks later, and see it a totally opposite thing. So there was always this, battle back and forth. You know, what does Paul say? Tossed and turned, to and fro by every wind of doctrine. And, you know, I think for many of us, that is kind of where we felt without this solid foundation of the law. And I think that when you return to it and you see, oh my goodness, this works. It's not this Catholic ritual. It's not just some ritual that sits up there, for us to do as a, almost a pagan sacrament. Rather, it has real world connotations and real world application. To me, that's just where it becomes alive. And oh my goodness, the joy that it occurs from it and the change in your life. When you can physically feel a change in how you feel and your energy and your attitude and everything, you just feel so much more alive. You're able to enjoy life. You're able to enjoy your family and your work and everything so much more because you have that gift of health. And, right. It's just, you definitely praise Yahweh for what he has given to us and teaching us how to live.
You definitely have a dialogue with the creator of the universe. I mean, a real life dialogue that you can point to, and you can point to the results of it in your life. You know, that excerpt we were talking about from Chronicles before, you know, the thing that none of us, we all pass right over it. And we don't really consider it, but it says, if my people who were called by my name.
Yes.
Now, who is that? Gee, I wonder who that is. You know, we need to stop taking pride in being Gentile believers. And we need to realize that we stand a really excellent chance of being Israelites. Go ahead.
You touched on a very important point, I think, with the Gentile believers, because there is this belief that if you are a Gentile, you should not, or it's optional whether or not you observe Torah.
Yeah.
And I just find that to be a doctrine, an ideology that harms so many people.
Yes.
Kashrut benefits you no matter who you are. If you follow it, you're going to have the blessing. So I think that when we seek to distinguish so much between Gentile or Goy or whatever you want to put in it, to whatever terminology, there's nothing that should stand between you and observing Torah and receiving the blessings. That's part of a relationship. And the more that we encourage people to in their Torah walk, the more blessing there will be for each and every one of us, the more community. I mean, can you imagine, rather than there just being two or three of us here online today, we had hundreds and thousands. The community that engenders is just, you feel connected. And it just surpasses the individual as you walk in the way.
Yes, I will happily give up the quote unquote freedom that I thought I had for what I have now.
Right.
There's no question. Right. No comparison.
Not at all. You just really, once you live it and once you see it, and then too, for me, once I did the research and it was like the research is just so compelling, that in itself was just very, convincing.
You know, in James, one of the ways that he describes the Torah, in James chapter 1, it says verse 25, but he who looks into the perfect Torah of liberty,
mm-hmm.
and continues in it, it is not a forgetful hearer, but doer the work, this one will be blessed in what he does. So there's liberty in the Torah.
Yeah. You know, and yet the very same people that say that's the inspired word of Yahweh will turn right around and say, we don't have to do it anymore. And I'm going, how do you do that? How do you reconcile what is very clearly spoken in the Brit Chadashah alongside the Torah and the Tanakh? How do we manage to take it and turn it around and say we don't have to do that anymore, even though we read every day excerpts that say things like that, Joe? It's amazing.
It is amazing.
And that's why people like you, Joe Dell, are a huge source of hope for me, because you're in a position where you can basically say, look, you know, we're breaking our own rules. we're taking the instruction that was given lovingly to us by our Heavenly Father, and we're trashing it. And we need to stop it.
You know, and it's funny because that's exactly what we do. It's like the self-inflicted suicide. And that was actually one of the curses of the law. Yahweh says in Deuteronomy 28, that you will be mad for the sight of your eyes to see. And that's what we have become. And we commit suicide, whether it's individually or communally or nationally, so often. You know, Nebuchadnezzar didn't fall upon Jerusalem because the nation was strong and independent and prosperous. He fell on the nation because they were failing. There was injustice, there was bloodshed, there were all these crimes that called for justice. And we forget that we often affect our own death. We affect our own consequences so many times because we follow in ways, we adopt philosophies and ideas that are alien to Torah, and they end up oppressing other people and dividing other people. And when that happens, there will be some group of people that will rise up in anger over that injustice, and they will seek retribution. That's the way it's worked for thousands of years. So the key is to get with the program so that you are walking in that law of liberty, so that you have that liberty in your life, and you're able to be that example in your interaction with other people. And by that, they can come to know Yahweh if they don't pick up a book. And then eventually, hopefully, they'll pick up a Tanakh and they will start reading so that they can learn from themselves. Because that's what it comes down to eventually. So even though this is a community effort, the choice has to be individual. It has to be the individual choice to learn Tanakh, to follow it, and to put it into action into your life. And, you know, so many of the people, the listeners today, are such a blessing in that, because they provide the example. They provide that link between a book and the rest of society.
Right. And, you know, you just got done quoting from the New Testament about looking into the perfect law of liberty. You know, I think you can take that and match it up directly with being a watchman on the wall. Mm-hmm. Because guess what? Whether we like it or not, we are the watchman on the wall. We're the ones that get to announce what we have discovered to others. And if we don't, we're letting Abba down. We're letting him down because he's counting on us to stand up for his truth and let them know. It says in the Tanakh, it says that if we don't do that, if we are not responsible watchmen on the wall, then the blood of those who go the wrong way because of us is on our hands.
That's absolutely right.
Jodell, where will your book be available?
We are looking at having it at the printers mid-January. Their production schedule is about 5 weeks. So I am saying tentatively the 1st of March. It will be sometime February or March. I just don't know how the production schedule will actually go with everything. So
where do you order it from?
I have a website. It is the Tetragrammaton, the YHWHExists.com. So YHWHExists.com.
And I love it. You know, didn't you say that you had over 100 pages of endnotes?
Yeah, I think it's right about 130 pages of endnotes.
Gee, maybe we ought to take you seriously, huh?
Yeah, I try to work off of atheist scholars, because I know when you're dealing in controversial subjects like I delved into, there's always the claim of bias. There's always the claim of, using someone just because their work is biased in and of itself. So I tried to get around all that by showing how the work of, especially this is more in archaeology and academic studies, that the work of academics who are known atheists, their research and their conclusions support the biblical narrative.
All right. Thank you, Jodell, for spending a day with us. Joe, can't thank you enough. I'll see you on Sunday.
Thank you so much, Joe and Jean.
Yes. Thank you. And we'll be back in a week.
The light now shines, the darkness must flee. The darkness must flee from the living word. His light now shines, the darkness must flee. Yeshua is the light of the world.